So, good afternoon to all. I'm very happy to be here, especially to deliver this lecture together with my colleague and friend, Professor Thomas Romer of the Collège de France. And maybe it is symbolic that the first two lectures present the results of a very strong cooperation, which is already going on between the two institutions, that is to say the excavations, the archaeological excavations, in the site of Kiryat Yarim, which is a very important biblical site located west of Jerusalem, about 10 kilometers to the west of Jerusalem. So today we wish to present the results of the excavations, and the idea is to show The idea is to show a good cooperation between an archaeologist and a biblical scholar. Now, there are two ways to do this. The first possibility to present this cooperation between an archaeologist and a biblical scholar is this one. You can see my friend Thomas Romer sitting on a bulk with whiskey and basically giving me orders what to do. There is another possibility in which I play the role of a pharaoh, a cruel pharaoh. You will see this maybe later. And because of my esteem to the Collège de France, I started with this picture rather than the other one. So the idea is to show how modern research in the field of biblical history can be done in a critical way. When I say in a critical way, I mean both on the side of archaeology, deploying all fields of modern archaeology, including, as you will see later, the exact and life sciences, which became very strong part, including physics-related fields, which became very important part, very strong part of archaeological research, and of course, a very critical way of looking at the biblical text. So the site of Kiryat Yarim that you see here, a very beautiful picture, is located to the west of Jerusalem. There is the monastery of the Arche d'Alliance, built in the 20th century, in the beginning of the 20th century, on top of it. And the site, the place, which is called in Arabic Deir el-Azhar, is very well identified with this place of Kiryat Yarim. And the identification is being done simply by, first of all, following the geographical description of the location of the border between the tribes of Judah and Benjamin west of Jerusalem in the book of Joshua in the Bible, which is very reliable and very exact. Secondly, the information given by Eusebius of the 4th century saying that the location of Kiryat Yarim is 9 miles from Jerusalem on the way to Diospolis, that is to say, on the way to the coastal plain. And finally, the preservation of the name, which is really fascinating, because the name in Arabic, Deir el-Azhar, apparently preserves the name Monastery of el-Azhar, the name of the Byzantine monastery constructed there in the 5th century after Christ, in order to commemorate the fact that, according to the biblical text, the Ark of the Covenant, when it was brought back from the Philistines, it was placed in this place, in Kiryat Yarim, for several years until it was, according to the text, to the story in the biblical text, brought from there to Jerusalem. So the name Deir el-Azhar is, in fact, the corruption of the name, the Byzantine name, the monastery of el-Azhar, because el-Azhar was the priest in charge of the ark when it was brought to this place. Kiryat Yarim appears in several places in the Bible. Thomas Romer will speak about it better than me later. First of all, as the location on the border between the inheritances of Judah and Benjamin in the book of Joshua. Then in the lists of towns of Judah and Benjamin. Of course, as related to the migration of the tribe of Dan and the towns of the Gibeonites. And more important, perhaps, than the others, the story of the history of the Ark of the Covenant between the site of Shiloh, when we have the beginning of the story, until it is located, according to the biblical text, in Jerusalem. And then, of course, also in the genealogies. We decided to go to Kiryat Yearim because of our long, ongoing cooperation of the two of us in the last 20 years or so, with the goal of approaching a site which had not been excavated properly in the past and deploying all modern research tools in order to clarify, first of all, the settlement history of the site, and especially to try to understand it vis-a-vis the biblical material that I have just mentioned. So, about the settlement history, we know quite a lot. The site is not very big, so it is not difficult to collect the information in order to reconstruct the history of settlement at the site. We know that it had been settled starting in the third millennium BC, in the Bronze Age, in the early phase of the Bronze Age, and then continued to be settled, but in low intensity, I would say, until a certain moment in the Iron Age when it became a very prominent site. So, especially in the 8th and the 7th centuries BC, a period that we describe as late monarchic, because this is the late phase of the two Hebrew kingdoms, Israel and Judah, at that time the site was very important. Then there was a decline for several centuries, according to the information that we have collected and surveys that have been conducted at the site before. And then again, some sort of a prosperity in the late Hellenistic and early Roman period. And then the Byzantine monastery. And Professor Omer and me will concentrate today on the first phase, which means on the first phase of prosperity, which means the 8th and 7th centuries BC. So this is a picture looking at the side of Kiryat Yearim from the north, from afar. And the first sight that we have, the first look that one can take at the site, it is very obvious to me, at least, that the site is not a normal hill in the highlands, which means it looks as if there was a human intervention in the shape of the place, and it looks to me as some sort of having been elevated artificially in order to form some sort of a platform on top of the site. So the question, the first research question that we put forward for in the first season of excavations, which took place in the summer of 2017, last year, so this is can be considered as breaking news. The first task that we put in front of us was to try to better understand the topography of the site, because we felt that this is the key for understanding the history of the place and connect it also to the historical texts, especially in the Bible. Before excavations, in the middle you can see a three-dimensional, what we call today autophoto, which means a picture taken by a drone with several hundreds of pictures, and then it creates a three-dimensional image of the site. And in a picture like this, we can see things more than in a normal picture, in a regular picture, and also more than one can see just walking at the site. But even without this picture, just walking at the site, as you can see on both right and left, there are very impressive terraces running in straight lines, 6, 7, and 10 meters high, surrounding the summit of the hill. This is not normal for a site in the highlands, especially the straight lines, because the site is a hill, you know, looks like a dome. So theoretically speaking, the terraces should have been round around the site. And here we see something that creates straight lines running for 100 meters and more on, in fact, four sides of the site. This can also be seen in this beautiful picture that had been taken by the Bavarian pilots during First World War. So the picture is from 1918, that is to say exactly 100 years ago. And at that time, the village of Abu Ghosh, which is around the Israeli village, Arab village west of Jerusalem, was not very big as today, and one can see the features of the site better than today. Also, the monastery that we saw before was only in its very beginning. So the lines of the terraces can be seen in this aerial picture. And in fact, in the autophoto, this is the real autophoto with the levels, one can see that the elevation of the top of the hill is identical all over, which means the top of the hill is flat And the flat part is really a very impressive one. And not regular for the typical hills of the highlands in the area of Jerusalem. So in order to better understand, we conducted a seismic geodetic investigation of the site with the help of friends from the Hebrew University, from the Department of Earth Science. They came, and the question that we put forward on the table was, can you please explain to us what was the original shape of the hill, bedrock? And if we get the original shape of the hill, we know a lot about the fields that were put in order to create the elevated platform. So in this picture in front of you, you can see that in certain places on the hill, the field is about 5 or 6 meters deep. So you can imagine the kind of work that had been done. The question, of course, is exactly when, in order to create this podium on top of the site. So all this was before we started the excavation. And then we had to ask ourselves, where are we exactly going to excavate in order to clarify the issue? Now, this is not a simple thing at Kiryat Yearim for two reasons. First of all, the place is inhabited. There is a monastery, a convent, L'Arche d'Alliance. And of course, we cannot interfere, we cannot intervene with the daily life of the nuns living there. And secondly, in the highlands, usually the summit of the sites are very much eroded. So even if it would have been possible to conduct excavation there, probably the results would have been kind of mixed stratigraphy, which is not good in modern archaeology, as you may understand. So after thinking, we decided to carry out three fields of excavations. Area A is in the north. The idea was to try to find whether there is a big wall of support in order to create the platform. A platform like this in the highlands cannot be created without big support walls and fields. So this was the first attempt. Secondly, area B on the right-hand side down, the southeastern part of the site. The idea was to do the same over there in order to check the eastern terrace which supports the platform. And then we also carried out excavations in area C on the slope below the elevated platform in order to better understand the history of the site in the Iron Age away from the top of the hill. So to start with this is a drawn picture taken at the end of the excavations. And the main achievement there, this is really interesting, we have collected quite a lot of information about the last years of the Kingdom of Judah. Now, we, of course, have had information like this also before, but there has been a major problem. One of the major problems in the archaeology of Judah in the Iron Age is that we cannot make proper distinctions, stratigraphic or chronological, in the last, let's say, 130 years of the Kingdom of Judah. And especially in the 7th century BC, when Judah was dominated by the Assyrian Empire, a phase very important in order to understand the development of the biblical text. So this is really an enigma. What can we say about the first half of the 7th century? So I cannot say much more today, but we feel now, after the first season, that we have a chance here to really be able to distinguish, to isolate this missing phase in the history, in biblical history, in archaeology, in biblical archaeology, of the first half of the 7th century. And this is going to be the target, one of the main targets of the second season, which we will carry out next summer at Kiryat Yearim. Now I'm moving back to the platform, because this will lead us to the biblical text. In fact, when Thomas is coming to speak here in a few minutes. So in the northern part of the site, there was a big success for us. We started excavation, and maybe 30 centimeters under the surface, we came across this big wall that you can see mainly on the right-hand side up, and then the continuation on the left side. This wall is really a very solid, quite immense. Here you can see it, and there can be no question that it is the wall going east-west in a straight line and supporting this platform that we are speaking about. So this is the northern part to the north of the convent. In the southeast, we have also been very successful. I must tell you something here about archaeologists' expectations and going to the field. My destiny has been the following. Whenever I had a question and I went to the field, I found evidence against it. And I was always amazed to see other colleagues going to the field with the research questions and always coming back with a positive answer. So I said to myself, what's wrong with me? What's going on? So I was on the verge of declaring myself as a not good enough archaeologist until I came to Kiryat Yarim and I really found what I was looking for. So it was really a big relief for me to be able to survive, so to speak, archaeologically or professionally. So we have also the big wall on the east supporting the same platform. Here is, again, the one in the east. You can see it is standing like 4 meters high. It is about 4 meters in width, a very solid one, was much higher in antiquity. And there are certain phases, as you can see on the right-hand side, more than one phase in this big wall. So if we take the information that we have collected, both on the surface and the aerial pictures and the excavations and the results in the two areas that I have just described, we can reconstruct a rectangular platform about 110 on 150 meters, a big one, on top of the site. So the next question, of course, is how to date it. It's good enough that we have you know, such a platform and evidence for this, but without dating, there's no use for the excavation, right? We need to know exactly when it was built. The problem is that conventional archaeology does not help here. Because in conventional archaeology, we date according to stratigraphy and ceramic typology, which means we are looking for the, especially the pottery and the finds, on floors approaching the big walls. The thing is that over here we are already, because we are on a platform and because of erosion, we are already under the floors. So this was impossible. And because of this, we had difficulty also to locate samples for radiocarbon dating. Radiocarbon dating today, you know, is a very strong tool that if deployed properly can give us an answer of uncertainty of 30 years on 3,000 years back. This is quite amazing, you know, in any field of research as a resolution. So what to do in a situation like this? We are in a desperate situation, right? So we decided to turn to another method of dating, which has been deployed recently in several places, and this is optically stimulated luminescence dating, OSL. What's the idea? This is again a physics-related discipline of dating. What's the idea? As I explain here, optical dating provides the time passed since quartz grains were buried and shielded from light exposure, which resets the luminescence signal. So we can check when a particle of quartz was buried in the ground and get an answer of, you'll see, plus minus 100 years. Now, this is not good enough, plus minus 100 years, right? But the question is, what question you are asking? Because if I'm asking a question between, let's say, the middle of the 7th century and the late 7th century, this is not a method that is going to rescue me. However, in the situation here, for reasons that I will explain in the next few minutes before I wrap it up, the question here was between the Iron Age, maybe in the 8th century, and Roman period. And for this, we can get an answer, a good answer, from OSL dating. So here is what we have done. These are the results. I'm not going to tire you. I'm not going to tire you. We cannot leave them in suspense. I'm not going to tire you with the details. Just take a look at the red box. The red box discloses the construction of the walls, because these samples were taken from the base of the walls in the very big courses laid there. So we have to pay attention to this. So here are the results. On the left-hand side in red, you can see between, we have three results for the time being, between, let's say, 1100 and 770, between around 1300 and 960, and between 1140 and 780. What to do with this? What can we do with this? Okay, so here it is. These dates that you have now on top cover the late Bronze Age, the beginning of the Iron Age, and then they go into the 8th century BC. Now, in order to construct a monumental podium like this, one can expect strong activity at the site, right? So archaeology tells us that strong activity at the site started only in the beginning of the 8th century. So in fact, only the date, the end of this range, in the very beginning of the 8th century, applies. We are in the 8th century BC. Now, in the 8th century BC, there are two possibilities. It's like a riddle, what I'm telling you, right? So the first possibility in the 8th century is an Assyrian, by the Assyrian Empire, construction. Let's just try to think about it for a minute. You know that Sennacherib, king of Assyria, conducted a military operation against King Hezekiah of Judah in 701 BC. So, theoretically speaking, the Assyrians could have constructed a podium, you know, administration to control Judah after the campaign, because Judah became a compliant vassal of Assyria even before, but definitely after the campaign of Sennacherib against Hezekiah. Another possibility is to pull back a little bit to the beginning of the 8th century under the northern kingdom of Israel, because in the beginning of the 8th century, we are still speaking about two kingdoms, Israel and Judah, living side by side. And the stronger one is the kingdom of Israel, as we will see in a minute. So here's just an example of what I imagine, what I can see to myself when I speak about Assyrian construction. This is a Google Earth picture of a site in southern Jordan, where one can very clearly see, under in the red circle, an elevated podium, which was probably constructed in order to control the Arabian trade route, a very important road of antiquity with the Arabian goods that led to Gaza and to the Mediterranean and then to the northern coasts of the Mediterranean. The problem is that an Assyrian construction at Kiryat Yarim is difficult because it could have come only after 732 and basically better after 701, and this is too late, as you may remember, for the radiocarbon dates, for the OSL dates, as you can see over here. So we are left with the possibility of a North Israelite podium. And this, of course, will lead to the lecture of Thomas here. So what are we doing here? This is a picture of Samaria from the air, the capital of the northern kingdom, of the kingdom of Israel, which lived side by side with Judah until it was taken over by Assyria between 722 and 720, 732 and 720 BC. And one can see easily that there is a big elevated podium on top of Samaria for the administration center of the kingdom of Israel. So the possibility is that we have a similar royal platform at Kiryat Yarim. So the spotlight, if we look again at the dates, the spotlight must be on two monarchs who are very important and strong in the very late 9th century and the beginning of the 8th century. The first one is Joash, and the second one is Jeroboam II, who was probably the most important and the strongest monarch of the kingdoms of Israel and Judah in the Iron Age. He is not very much praised in the biblical text, of course, because the text had been written by authors from Judah, and they probably intentionally trying to downplay his importance in antiquity, because at that time, Israel controlled the kingdom of Judah. And as you can see, on the left-hand side, this was the time when the territory of the Kingdom of Israel was the maximal, and he was able even to play a role along the southern roads of the Arabian trade in the desert. And in a site in the desert, we have a small piece of fresco that you can see on the right-hand side. This is a king sitting on his throne, and many of us think that this is a depiction of Jeroboam II. If this is the case, we have the only depiction of an Israelite or a Judahite, well, except for maybe Jehu later in the Black Obelisk, but one of the only representations of a Hebrew monarch in antiquity. So here it is. Was the platform constructed by Israel during the reign of Jeroboam II as the domination center over Judah in general and Jerusalem in particular, because we have this chronistic text in the Bible in 2 Kings 14, verses 11 to 14, speaking about the fact that Israel took over the kingdom of Judah in the days of King Joash, the father of Jeroboam II. So is this the situation? Is this what we are seeing here? Question mark. So finally, let me just say that this is an open question, and we will have to continue dealing with it next season. And Professor Romer will speak about the biblical material vis-a-vis this idea. There is one another single, very small, interesting clue that we found this season. You can see in one place, there is a drafted stone that we found. Now, this drafted stone, the one here on the left-hand side down, a stone like this is typical of what? Mainly of the Iron Age in the Northern Kingdom, not in Judah, and the Hellenistic period. So the question is whether it is Iron Age or Hellenistic. Here are three examples of Iron Age, similar blocks, drafted blocks, from Dan in the north, in Israel, in the Kingdom of Israel, Megiddo, which is a site that I am excavating, a part of Kiryat Yearim, and the capital Samaria. So the question is, was there a temple? Because this kind of block is from a monumental building, palace, temple, center of administration. So here's the question. Was there a temple at the site related to the Ark because of the story of the Ark? And Thomas Romer will now provide the answers. Before we turn to Thomas, I am coming to this wedding from the side of the bride, right? Archaeology. So let's take a look at archaeology. Here are the baskets where we put our finds. So you can see glass, animal bones, samples, small finds. Unfortunately, all the baskets at the end of the dig were full, except the one on the left, the Ark. So the Ark, we don't have it yet. All this has been achieved because of the wonderful cooperation with the Collège de France. The Collège de France was represented by several wonderful archaeologists. Christophe Nicole sitting here in the middle, Juliette Ma sitting next to him, and other archaeologists, Thomas Romer sitting in the middle, but at the same day he was not at Kiryat Yearim, but we cherish his presence there and make it clear that we don't forget for a minute. And this is the team, and I thank you very much for your attention.
Bonjour. As you have seen, we speak in English for this session. Tomorrow there will be something in French in the Academy if you would like to hear us in French, Israel, me. So we have a long story together. It started since 20 years. I was not yet at the Collège de France, but in the University of Lausanne, when Israel Finkelstein wrote this very famous book, and I think this is a really still until today one of the most important book, called in English The Bible Unearthed, in French La Bible dévoilée. I think many people here have read the book, and I think this really challenged a lot of things, also in the way how archaeologists and biblical scholars should collaborate. And I think this was something like a starting point for a long long history of collaboration that we have, and which was materialized last year in Kiryat Yearim, but there were other things before, so I don't want to go into detail. We can discuss all this. But I would like to start with the other picture. So Israel showed you one, I showed you the other version. And in a way, it's quite typical. You can always have two point of views. The archaeologists have their point of views, and the biblical scholar have their point of view. And I think this is a little bit also what it's all about. There was a long time, there was a little difficulty between biblical scholars and archaeologists to collaborate. Either the biblical scholars, conservative biblical scholars, were thinking that archaeology should prove that the Bible is right, and some conservative archaeologists, they were convinced that the Bible is right, and there was just not interesting what critical biblical scholars were doing. So our challenge, in a way, is to try to work everybody from his own side, but then to go into discussion and to see what's coming out. And this is something I'm very happy, because it works very well with Israel. And I think we have some interesting results that can sometimes challenge the traditional way. And I will try now to illustrate this with the Ark. Israel didn't speak so much of the Ark, but the site of Kiryat Yearim, as you may know, it's very much related to the Ark of the Covenant, maybe in the beginning just the Ark of Yahweh or the Ark of God. So what I would like to do in the 20 minutes is to give you some hints about the Ark traditions in the Bible, and then specifically about the relation between the Ark traditions and the site of Kiryat Yearim. And this is very interesting, as you will see, because according to the Bible, the Ark came very quickly to Jerusalem. So if the Bible is right, I think there is no shrine in Kiryat Yearim. But if the Bible is wrong, or if the Bible is like interpreted with an ideological concept, then maybe we can have some interesting ideas about the shrine of Kiryat Yearim. But let me start a little bit more general about the Ark. As you know, the Ark has always fascinated people until today. So if you speak about the Ark, you can see all kind of stuff, paintings, Hollywood movies, you all know the Raiders of the Lost Ark. And I think it's not a secret, when it was known that Israel and me were starting about excavating Kiryat Yearim, Israel got some phone calls from some Hollywood movies directors that wanted to come and showed us taking and finding the Ark. But when we explained what we're doing, they were not so much interesting anymore. So let's come back. If we have just a little overlook about the Ark in the Bible, there's different ways to speak about the Ark. Most people know the Ark like this. This comes from a description in the book of Exodus, which is a very late description from priestly writers, where it's like covered by a cherubim and a kind of sanctuary which contains the tablets of testimony, whatever that is. Then we have in the book of Numbers and the book of Joshua, there are conquest accounts of the east, on the west of the Jordan, where the Ark is like a symbol of the divine presence and ported by priests or Levites. Then you all know, but this is something I cannot speak today, according to the book of Deuteronomy and to the book of Kings, the Ark is the container of the tablets of the law. And it said there is nothing in the Ark except the two tables of the law. And if somebody says there's nothing else, then you may ask there was maybe something others. But and then, of course, what is of interest for us today is that the Ark is the major character of the so-called Ark narrative. So what is this Ark narrative? If tonight you don't go to the movies or you don't watch TV, read the Bible and read the book of Samuel. In the book of Samuel, you have some chapters that were called the Ark narrative. And this is an idea of Leonard Rost almost 100 years ago. He was claiming that the chapters 4 to 7
In the first book of Samuel and the second, and in second chapter, second book of Samuel, chapter 6, that they constitute an independent story about the ark, how it was captured in Shiloh and brought to the Philistine territories and then came back from Shiloh to Judah and Kiriath Jearim and then finally ended up in Jerusalem. So the idea of this was that it's written by a priest of the ark, maybe even in the time of David and Solomon, and the way to understand or to make the people understand how the ark arrived in the temple of Jerusalem. And this is an idea that was accepted by many scholars. It's true, if you read these chapters, the prophet Samuel is not playing a role, Saul is not mentioned, so it's really an independent story. But the question is whether the end of this story was really the transfer of the ark to Jerusalem. Because this chapter in 2 Samuel 6 is separated from the other story. And there's a lot of problems if this really was the original ending. So if 2 Samuel 6 was the original ending, David, who's transferring the ark, is never introduced in the whole story. There are different names linked to the people who take care of the ark. In 1 Samuel 4-6, the ark is clearly identified with the God of Israel and is acting like it. Like in 2-6, it's more like a cultic symbol. And also, if you do some philology to look to the Hebrew text, you can see that the style and the vocabulary are very, very different. And finally, if really the original idea of the ark story was to show how the ark comes to Jerusalem, there's no allusion to Jerusalem in the foregoing chapter. So if this would have been the hero's logos of Jerusalem, it's very astonishing. So 2 Samuel 6 was not part of the original narrative. But if this is true, then it becomes interesting, because then the original narrative ended with the coming of the ark to the site Israel spoke to you, to Kiriath Jearim. So let us look a little bit now to this ark story and also, in a way, how archaeology and biblical studies can work together. So I cannot read you the story, it's too long. The story starts with a battle between the Philistines and the Israelites. And the Israelites lose the battle and they think we have to take the ark which is in Shiloh. And it's never explained how the ark came to Shiloh. The ark is in Shiloh. So it's apparently really an independent ark tradition which is connected to the sanctuary of Shiloh, which is in the north, in the mountains of Ephraim. And here again, I think it's interesting if you bring the Bible together with archaeology, because again, my good friend Israel Finkelstein was doing some work in Shiloh, showing that the site was abandoned or destroyed in the 11th century and then sparsely repopulated during the 8th and 7th century. The temple of Shiloh has not been found yet. There are some evangelical digs now, but I don't comment on this. It's not important. What is important that apparently this place of Shiloh in biblical memory is important because they never really tell about the destruction. But when it comes to the reflection about the destruction of the temple of Jerusalem, then we have a very strange situation, because I cannot go in all the details, but the Book of Kings, which are the story of the monarchy until the destruction of Jerusalem, were revised, redacted by Judean redactors who were in favor of one sanctuary in Jerusalem, what we call sometimes cult centralization, and we call these people with a not so nice name, we call them the Deuteronomists because they're very much relating on the book of Deuteronomy. But what I wanted to show you is in the book of Jeremiah, which was also redacted by those people, when they explain the destruction of the temple, they say it's the same that God did before with Shiloh. So if they go to Shiloh and see what I did to the place, this is God who's speaking through the mouth of the prophet, go and see what I've done to Shiloh, the place where I first have made my name dwell. So Shiloh is here considered to be like a forerunner of the Temple of Jerusalem. And this is very, very intriguing because it shows you that for these late redactors, still they had a memory of Shiloh, and it's a northern sanctuary. And this is redacted by people from the south. So it's really, really interesting and shows how important this place were. And this is also very interesting because, as you may know, and I will come to this very quickly, the story of the Ark starts with the capturing of the Ark and the end of the priestly dynasty. You can read it all in your Bibles. What is interesting is that the destruction of Shiloh is never told in the Bible. It's abandoned, and the Ark is not coming back to it. The Ark is now deported first to Ashdod, and this practice of deportation is also very interesting because you can compare it to deportation of divine statues. This is a practice we know from the old Babylonians already until the Assyrians and also the Neo-Babylonians. So if you capture the deity of the enemies, the statues, you bring them to your own temple, as you can see also here. This is probably related to the capture of the Philistine city of Gath, and when Sargon II is taking Samaria, he said that he deported the gods in which they had put their trust, which shows you also that in Samaria there was not only the God of Israel, there were many other gods that the Assyrian deported. And then the Ark story shows us how powerful the Ark is, because the Ark is brought into the temple of the Philistine god Dagon, Dagan, and of course this reminds of this practice I just told you, but interestingly, it's like a counter history now. The Ark is brought in front of Dagon, so the next day they come and look what happened, and Dagon is falling down before the Ark, so as if he has to bow to prostrate before the Ark. And then the second day even, the statue is amputated in a way that Assyrian smashed divine statues. You can even think about such pictures as we have from the Assyrians. And then the Ark is traveling around Philistine cities, especially Gath and Ekron, before it's coming to Judahite territory. And here we can make some relations maybe with the time of King Hezekiah or a little bit later, because the fact that you have here the map, how it's going to Ashdod, to Gath, to Ekron, and then Beit Shemesh, and Giviat or Kiryat Yerim. If we look to Assyrian inscriptions, we can see that Hezekiah, who revolted against the Assyrian, was invaded by them. They took territories from him and gave them to Philistine cities. And you have this inscription where we have Ashdod, Ekron, and Gaza. In the story of the Ark, we have Gath instead of Gaza, which may be for geographical reasons. So this may be that at one stage of the story of the Ark, there was a revision, a Judahite revision of the oldest story, in order to reflect the situation of conflict between the kingdom of Judah and the Philistine coast, maybe during the reign of Hezekiah or Manasseh. So this is an indication not yet related to Kiryat Yerim, but we will come to it. Before we come to Kiryat Yerim, the Ark is stopping in another place. It's stopping in a place called Beit Shemesh. Beit Shemesh is apparently considered to be a border city, but in the story, it's already a Judahite city because the lords of the Philistine, they don't enter anymore into the territory. So it's a very complicated situation. In some lists, Beit Shemesh appears to be a city of Judah, sometimes even a Levitical city, but it's not mentioned in the list of cities of Judah in another list in the second part of chapter 15, which may indicate that it had come at some times under the control of the Philistines, which in a way is also what is said in 2 Chronicles 28. So the story as we have it here is claiming now that Beit Shemesh, where the Ark is brought by the Philistines, is belonging to the kingdom of Judah. But Beit Shemesh is not the final destination of the Ark. Beit Shemesh, there's a very strange story which can give all kind of interpretation. The Ark is killing the inhabitants of Beit Shemesh because they had looked at the Ark of Yahweh or inside the Ark, which may indicate that the Ark contained something that you could not look at. So maybe kind of a statue or something like that. And this is the reason why finally the Ark is coming to Kiryat Yearim. And the people of Kiryat Yearim came and took up the Ark of Yahweh and brought it to the house of Avinadav on the hill. They consecrated his son Eleazar to have charge of the Ark of Yahweh. And this would be the end of the original Ark narrative, the coming of the Ark to Kiryat Yearim. Because it's very interesting, the Ark was captured from Shiloh. So normally we can imagine if they captured from Shiloh, the Ark should have come back again to Shiloh. But this is not the case. So it's really a transfer, but not to Jerusalem immediately. The transfer is to Kiryat Yearim that replaced the shrine of Shiloh. So I go quickly to this problem because there are different way in the Bible to speak about Kiryat Yearim. Sometimes it's called Kiryat Baal or sometimes even Baalah. Some people think this is the older name, and some people think Baalah is a later polemic because the sanctuary was not considered anymore as a legitimate sanctuary, but there is no clear indication of such a possible polemical usage. So the theory that we had also while digging in Kiryat Yearim is maybe to indicate or to postulate that Baalah, or Kiryat Baal, was more specifically the high place that Israel showed you, the platform where a shrine or something was standing. And it's interesting because in 1 Samuel 7, when the Ark is brought to Kiryat Yearim, it's brought later to a givah, to a hill. From Kiryat Yearim, it's going up. And also when David and Israel went up then to fetch the Ark, it's also a location on a hill. And we have even givat Kiryat in the Masoretic text. So it's probably the platform, which is called Givat Kiryat or Baalah. And then the question is to what Baalah is referring. Is this another deity or something else? But which is clear that the story ends with the installation of priesthood, a consecration of priest, as we have it in the book of Leviticus, and the name of Eleazar, as Israel pointed out, is still maintained in the present name, Der Elazar, and is maybe a link that the authors wanted to inscribe it to Aaronite or Levitical priesthood. So, as you have seen, the first season showed the importance of the site of Kiryat Yearim, and as Israel told you, the sanctuary, the church, is called Notre-Dame de l'Arche de l'Alliance. So it's a long memory. It's on an older Byzantine church. And so we can imagine also that the older Byzantine church was built on an older, whatever, sanctuary. And so here comes the idea that, as Israel showed you already, if we take seriously the dates of the wall, Jeroboam II can be indeed a good candidate for the construction of the sanctuary, because only under Jeroboam II Israel reached a maximal territorial expansion, controlled also the tribe of or the the territory of Benjamin. So maybe he did the same with Kiryat Yearim that he did with Dan and Bethel and built it as a border sanctuary. So the oldest version on 1 Samuel 6, 4 to 6, before its revision by Judean redactors, would then be the story how Kiryat Yearim became the sanctuary of the Ark. So at the end, in 1 minute, why then and when did the Ark come to Jerusalem? It's a very easy thing for me. In the Book of Kings, the Ark is only mentioned until chapter 8, until the construction of the temple by Solomon. Solomon puts it in the temple, and then we don't hear anything anymore. There's a lot of wars where the Israelites or the Judahites could have taken the Ark. They never do it. There is a silencing about the Ark. And I think the most easy answer is there is a silencing because this story was written towards the end of the monarchy. It was probably written 50 years before the end of the monarchy. So here we come back to our good friend Josiah. And Josiah probably was the one when he controlled again Benjamin, and he had this idea, or his scribes and counselors had the idea of cult centralization. Probably he was the one who fetched the Ark from Kiriath Jearim to bring it to Jerusalem. So the Ark was not standing 20 years in Kiriath Jearim, as one text in the Bible says. You have to put another zero, 200 years, not 20, but 200 years. So, and then we still have a very interesting indication, and I will stop with this. In the Book of Chronicles, when Josiah is doing his reform, there's a strange text where he says to the Levites, put the holy ark in the house that Solomon, son of David, king of Israel, built. You need not longer carry it anymore on your shoulders. Here you got the impression it's for the first time it's introduced to the temple. So maybe this escaped censorship in a way. So, first version of the ark narrative under Jeroboam II, and that fits what we can say on the archaeological site. Here's the logos of the shrine of Kiriath Jearim. The revision of the Ark narrative under Josiah, the addition of the text, how it was transferred, but also later revisions that go on until the Babylonian and Persian period. And these three layers shows you, in a way, that a biblical scholar can also be an archaeologist. Not as good as the real ones, but still we try our best. Thank you very much. So, Israel, would you like to react, or would you like me to ask a question?
I have a question, Thomas, to you, which in fact we did not discuss at the in the field. So the question is the following. I perfectly understand the logic of the story from the point of view of Judah, Josianic times, Deuteronomistic ideas, and so on. I perfectly understand the logic of the story from the point of view of Josianic ideology, Deuteronomistic ideology of the late 7th century, of inheriting the Ark to Jerusalem, maybe even I would take another step forward and say, of eradicating a little bit the history of the Ark as an object of the North. My question to you is, okay, if this is the case, how do you see the importance of this object? Was it an Israelite object, a Northern Kingdom object? And if so, when did it acquire its importance? Only in the days of Jeroboam II, before? Because any way we look at it, also the connection with Shiloh is difficult because of the gap of about two centuries before the destruction of Shiloh and the reign of Jeroboam II.
Yeah, it's a very good and important question. Oui, après. On va juste discuter 10 minutes, après on laisse toutes les questions, tout à fait. So I just want to... So still, the idea is that we can have just a little exchange and then you can enter the discussion. So the question is about the origin of the Ark. And I think it's a very difficult question, but still, if you look, and this is why I did also this little excursus on Shiloh, it is never explained in the Bible how the Ark came to Shiloh. Later they try so and so, but it's not clear. So I think originally the Ark is related to Shiloh, and this is maybe also one of the explanations why then Shiloh is considered to be something like a first chosen sanctuary by the God of Israel. That's for sure. Of course, there's a gap. The interesting question is that we don't know exactly what happened to the sanctuary of Shiloh. I don't know if the new excavation will shed some lights on that or not. If it was destroyed under the Philistines in the 11th century, then there is a gap, but we have often like gaps like this, and this is something which can be kind of long durée in a way. I think it's also possible, some people would argue that Shiloh was destroyed later in the second or by the Assyrians or whatever. So it's complicated, but I would think it's a northern tradition. It's a northern tradition, and also you see how later the biblical redactors struggle in transforming the Ark. This I had no time to show. I showed this in my lectures in the college. The Ark was not originally the container of the tablets of the law, or the tablets of testimony, or whatever. It was really a portable sanctuary, probably containing a statue of the God of Israel, or maybe even its consort, if we take the two tablets. So, yeah. And maybe I can also just ask one question, and then yes, I know. We will open the field, don't? I know this gentleman, he has always questions. So it's a more general question, because also I think the idea of this workshop is to show how we try to collaborate and to work together. And so what I would, I think we had very often this kind of discussion, what I would like to ask Israel is how there was kind of a polemic once with his good friend and our good friend Nadav Naaman. And the question was, can archaeology be the high court of biblical studies? It means, can archaeology be the the one who has that has the last word if it comes to questions? So I don't know if you want to say one word and then maybe we open the field.
The one word is no.
No. Okay. So I'm relieved. I'm very much relieved. And this is also something I saw, because maybe if I would have known Israel in an earlier life, maybe I would have become archaeologist too, because I really enjoyed this experience. But also I realized how close, in a way, is biblical scholarship and archaeology, because it's all about interpretation. You get some facts, and then you have to
put them... And it's all about excavations of layer by layer.
Yeah, absolutely.